and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masterson. Today on this Christmas holiday, we will explore the historical Jesus whose birth Christians around the world are celebrating. James Carroll, the distinguished scholar in residence at Suffolk University and a columnist for the Boston Globe, joins us. He is a former priest who has been a civil rights worker, an anti-war activist, and a community organizer, as well as a best-selling author whose books received the first Thomas Merton Award and include An American Requiem, God, My Father, and the War That Came Between Us, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the Ancient City That Ignited the Modern World, and his New York Times bestseller, Constantine's Sword, which provided the basis for an award-winning documentary. James Carroll's new book just out is Christ Actually, the Son of God for the Secular Age, and we will look into the effects of Christian anti-Semitism on contemporary faith and examine the historical roots of prejudice that ultimately led to the Holocaust, along with its relationship with the religious violence dominating our current political climate, both in regards to the seemingly endless cycle of violence in the Middle East, as well as the recent upswing in anti-Semitism occurring globally. And joining us now is James Carroll, a distinguished scholar in residence at Suffolk University and a columnist for the Boston Globe. The author of 11 novels and 7 works of nonfiction, James Carroll is a former priest who has been a civil rights worker, an anti-war activist, and a community organizer in Washington and New York. He served as Catholic chaplain at Boston University and then left the priesthood to become a writer. He was named Best Columnist of the Year by the Catholic Press Association and received the first Thomas Merton Award. And his books include House of War, The Pentagon, and The Disastrous Rise of American Power, An American Requiem, God, My Father, and The War That Came Between Us, and Jerusalem, Jerusalem, The Ancient City That Ignited the Modern World. And his New York Times bestseller, Constantine's Sword, provided the basis for an award-winning documentary. James Carroll's new book, just out, is Christ Actually, the Son of God for the Secular Age. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Carroll.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to be back.
And let me start out with a kind of quiz for you here, James.
Sure.
Let me quote somebody and see if you can guess who it is. It is not necessary to believe in God to be a good person. In a way, the traditional notion of God is outdated. One can be spiritual, but not religious. It is not necessary to go to church and give money. For many, nature can be a church. Some of the best people in history did not believe in God, while some of the worst deeds were done in his name. Any ideas of who?
Well, you know, it could be any number of people I know and love. It's a sentiment that I would say is quite common. I don't know in particular who you can attribute that quote to.
Tell me. Pope Francis.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
What does that mean
to you, Ian?
Having covered the Pope's predecessors and tried to kind of cover religion and the Catholic Church, and of course, as you know, there's been several years of rather hideous scandal associated with the Church, you know, my sense is, you know, this is more than a breath of fresh air. You know, this could be a total sea change for the Catholic Church.
It's true. Pope Francis has already changed the Church in enormous ways. Just this emphasis on mercy over law has changed the way Catholics understand themselves. It's changed the way bishops and priests are relating to Catholic lay people. It's even changed the way, just recently, that the Vatican has been dealing with American nuns. Pope Francis has really brought about very profound change, and here's hoping that it goes further and really fulfills the promise of this beginning.
So let's talk about your new book, Christ Actually, the Son of God for the Secular Age. As we celebrate Christmas, of course, I think some people think about the person who was born in the manger, and I find it extraordinary that this prophet Jesus' whole experience has been so lost or misrepresented. I mean, if I think the historical Jesus, in political terms, was a left-wing revolutionary, but he's become a kind of right-wing fundraiser in America. So when you talk about the Jewishness of Jesus Christ, what do you mean?
Well, you know, It's normal down through the centuries for Christians and people of the West to see Jesus through the lens of their own experience. So it's not surprising in a way that left-wing revolutionaries would like to claim him as one of themselves, and right-wing fundamentalists equally would like to claim him. I grew up in an Irish Catholic family. The truth is, Ian, we thought of Jesus as Irish Catholic. I mean, it's normal for people to see him in through the lens of their own experience. The trouble with this is it can be very distorting. And down through the centuries, the most important distortion that took place was the way in which Christians forgot, in a way, the most important thing about Jesus' life story, which was that he was fully Jewish. He was a Jew to the day he died. He was what we would call today an Orthodox Jew. That sounds obvious, but the truth is the Christian memory has recreated Jesus as if he were a Gentile, and that's because the Gospels themselves tell the story of Jesus as if it's a story against the Jewish people. There's a phrase in the Gospels, the Jews, which is used almost always in a denigrating way. And that phrase, a polemical phrase really, appears in the Gospels and the Acts of the Apostles over 100 times to tell the story of Jesus against the Jewish people as if he were not one of them. And the trouble, of course, with this perspective is that it becomes eventually the ground of religious anti-Judaism, which morphs ultimately into racial anti-Semitism. And in my own view, lays the groundwork for a further positive-negative bipolarity, which is white racism, white people against people of color. So my argument in Christ Actually is that we have to reclaim, in a very basic way, the Jewishness of Jesus and understand his story fully in the context of Jewish life, the life of Israel in the time he lived.
Well, of course, the notion that the Jews killed Christ has become grist for the mill in terms of anti-Semitism. And I believe one of the Orthodox Christian Easter Masses begins with the invocation, the Jews killed Christ. I don't know whether that's still used, but there's no question about the distortion of history here. But when you talk about we need to revisit and re-understand the Jewishness of Jesus Christ, what does that say to you?
Well, you know, when we tell the story of Jesus, Ian, his virtue, his openness, his generosity, his mercy, the universal message he brings, we usually tell the story in contrast to the Jewish milieu in which he lives. So, for example, he tells the parable of the Good Samaritan. That parable could equally well be called the parable of the bad Jews, because the story of the Samaritan, a non-Jewish outsider who rescues the man who was beaten by robbers, is his virtue stands in contrast to the high priest and the Levite, the lawyer, the Jewish lawyer who passed the man on the other side of the road. So the Good Samaritan equals the bad Jew. So much of the story of Jesus is told this way. The openness Jesus has to women is put in contrast to what's taken to be a kind of Jewish misogyny, a Jewish contempt for women. The mercy of Jesus is contrasted with the legal obsessiveness of the Jews and so forth. By the time you get to St. Paul, this positive-negative structure of mind is understood to take the form of law versus grace, God's mercy versus God's judgment. Ultimately, Ian, the New Testament over against the Old Testament, a new, vital, forward-looking religion over against an old, obsolete, passé religion. This basic structure of the imagination informed Christianity, the church, and ultimately Western civilization. And it's a deadly, deadly bipolarity. And the antidote to it is to go right back to the beginning and understand that Jesus was not against the Jews. Jesus was rather everything he said, preached, believed, and stood for unfolded from within the traditions of Israel. And that's a crucial recovery that we Christians have only barely begun. It's true, and thankfully, that the churches have overwhelmingly rejected the Christ killer charge. But that's only the tip of the iceberg. It's the entire way we remember Jesus as if he were not Jewish.
Well, I think it seems that we forgot about the Romans who did crucify Jesus Christ.
In the Gospels, of course, the story is told to emphasize the relative benign character of the Romans. So Pontius Pilate, for example, the governor of Palestine at the time, a Roman petty tyrant, actually, if ever there was one, a man who would have thought nothing of dispatching a troublemaking Galilean nobody. And yet in the gospel he is given to us as a man who oversees the trial of Jesus, finds Jesus to be innocent of any charges, and puts Jesus before the crowd and says he's innocent. And the gospels have the crowd forcing Pilate's hand, crying, "Crucify him, crucify him." Pilate brings out a bowl of water, washes his hands, a dramatic gesture, and says, "I am innocent of this man's blood." And the crowd is made to say, "Let his blood be upon us and upon our children." The important thing for Christians to know today is no such thing happened. We know from other sources that Pontius Pilate was not a benign figure like that. He was so brutal that not long after the death of Jesus, he was removed by Rome for violating even Rome's tough standards of oppression. So why did the Gospels come to be written that way? It's a crucial question for Christians. And it puts on Christians the obligation to understand far more fully than we do how the Gospels came to be written, when they were written, who wrote them, and what was the context within which these texts emerged. It's hard work, but it's crucially important work. Nothing less than life and death depends on it, because the consequences of Christian misremembering down through the centuries has been the deaths of many, many innocent people.
And again, I'm speaking with James Carroll, distinguished scholar in residence at Suffolk University and a columnist for the Boston Globe, the author of 11 novels and 7 works of nonfiction. James Carroll is a former priest who became a civil rights worker, an anti-war activist, and a community organizer in Washington and New York. His New York Times bestseller, Constantine Sword, provided the basis for an award-winning documentary, and James Carroll's new book just out is Christ Actually, the Son of God for the Secular Age. So in terms of this historical distortion of the role of the Romans and the role of Pontius Pilate, clearly the way that the Gospels tell the story, it's the treachery of the hierarchy of the Jewish establishment, isn't it? That basically they're the, in Shakespearean terms, they're the Brutuses.
Yes, it's true. They are the villain. Aristotle said that every story needs a conflict, and the Gospel writers chose to make the conflict Jesus has with the Jewish establishment, but not only the establishment, with his own people. He is shown being attacked by the people of his home village, Nazareth, which leads to that paradigmatic phrase, a prophet is without honor in his own country. The Gospel of John begins with the phrase, he came unto his own, and his own received him not. Ian, that's wrong. The only people who received Jesus were Jews, all of them. In the lifetime of Jesus, all of his followers were Jews. The people who loved him and couldn't let go of their affection for him were Jews. So how did it come to be told that he was himself a Gentile, in effect? And the answer is the great interruption in history that took place decades after the death of Jesus. In the year 70, the Romans, in a savage war against the Jewish people, destroyed the Temple of Israel, generating a crisis among all Jews. What is it to be a Jew without the temple, which has centered our faith for 1,000 years? And there were two answers. The first, now more than ever, the temple is the imagined temple of law observance and study of Torah. And the second, the Jesus people, now the new temple is Jesus. And the argument between these two groups of Jews, both responding to the same crisis, became polemical and fierce. It was, in effect, a kind of civil war. generated by the Roman war against the Jews. And the record of that war is the Gospels, because the Gospels were written exactly in this period. The oldest Gospel, Mark, dates to, scholars tell us, about the year 70, exactly when the temple was destroyed. I argue that it's not a coincidence, Ian. In fact, I argue that the Gospels were written as a way of making sense of this terrible, calamitous, catastrophic experience that Jews went through in those decades. So in the years that the Gospels were being written and the church was coming into its own, the Romans were devastating the Jewish people. And that devastation is what caused the trauma. You could think of this as post-traumatic stress syndrome, caused the trauma of misremembering, leading to the Gentiles in the movement beginning to think of Jesus as if he himself were one of them, and as if he were set against the Jewish people. And within decades, ultimately, Christians began to think of the Jewish people as the enemies of God, which was ultimately a lethal idea.
And, of course, in this discussion, James Carroll, it's difficult not to think about both what people are celebrating at Christmas and all of the names in the Bible, starting with Bethlehem, and what's happening today, of course, in those very same lands that are heavily contested. And the Jewish religion lives on as it was back then. And my understanding that the sort of fundamental defense of Christianity versus Judaism comes down to this idea that the contribution that Jesus made, in effect, was turning the other cheek, and that the eye for an eye, we're still beset by that old paradigm. Can you...
Well, I must admit, Ian, after doing this work, I see things slightly differently. There was a time when I'd have agreed with your interpretation.
Well, now, it's not necessarily my interpretation, but it's the broad one, that the great contribution that Christianity made was the turning the other cheek, as opposed to being locked in the dynamic of an eye to an eye for an eye, which, of course, we can argue is still going on in the Middle East.
Right. Well, fair enough. All I would say, though, is that even the benign teachings of Jesus, for example, his rejection of violence, comes fully out of the character of the people of Israel. Take that phrase, an eye for an eye. In our terms, that is usually heard or understood as a kind of ruthless rule of revenge. You take my eye, I take your eye. But in fact, that came into the experience of the biblical people as a restriction on violence, because the much more typical response to the loss of an eye would be to kill the other party. And an eye for an eye is a restriction on violence. If someone takes your eye, you can do no more to them than take their eye. If someone, it introduces, in other words, the notion of proportionality into this question of how human disputes are resolved. And proportionality, as you know, goes on to be one of the pillars of what's called the just war theory. The idea that violence has to be limited by moral standards, by the test of what's humane. And the move away from violence that we associate with Jesus really begins with the biblical people. And Jesus is of that people. So the clear rejection of violence that Jesus asserts is to be seen not in contrast to the Jewish people, but in contrast to Rome, the Empire of Rome, which was built on violence, depended on people's dread of violence. And when Jesus says no to violence, he's saying no to Rome. That's the crucial element here, and it's relevant to us too, of course, because imperial systems always depend on violence. And that's what Jesus invites all people, certainly including and centrally including Christians, to say no to the violence of empires. And that's a message this Christmas time that must really be taken seriously by those of us who live in the United States of America, because we ourselves, over the last decade and a half, have been guilty of terrible imperial violence, which has wreaked havoc through whole sections of the world, especially centered, of course, in in the Middle East.
Well, arguably the great challenge that America faces is whether the Republic will survive the empire. I mean, there is clearly a contest here, is there not? I mean, one way of putting it would be, why are we filling potholes in Kabul and not filling potholes in Main Street, USA?
That's one way to put it. I agree with your general assertion there. I myself am somewhat obsessed lately with the revelations tied to the CIA torture report that came from the Senate. And it is an absolute exhibit A of the point you just made. Will the Republic survive the empire? Will a Republic committed to democratic liberal ideals survive what we are doing to ourselves with the obsessive creation of a national security state? Because the national security state depends on the threat of and then the exercise of violence, which these days is impossible to control, to restrict. The famous drone program, which is justified by American officials because it is supposed to be immune from collateral damage, that's not true. The collateral damage attached to drone attacks is quite savage. We are living in a period when basic American ideas and ideals are being undermined by our own government. And the story of Christmas is actually a quite relevant morality tale, because even at the beginning, the story of the baby in the manger, the story of Mary and Joseph going off from Nazareth to Bethlehem, why are they going? They're going because the empire is taking a census, and they have to go back to the family hometown to register for the census. That's how the Christmas story begins. And what is the census? The census is a tool of ruthless imperial control. The empire needs to know the name and address of everybody under its power as a way of collecting taxes, for starters, but in general as a way of keeping people under the thumb of control. So the innocent, lovely, sweet, romantic nativity story is actually a parable of life under an oppressive imperial power. And the story is told in such a way to make it very clear that this baby is himself going to be opposed by and ultimately murdered by that same imperial power. But the great turnabout in the Christmas story, which is then fulfilled in the gospel narrative itself, is that this baby will be triumphant over the great enemy, Caesar Augustus. So right there in the Christmas story, we have the proper structure of imagination that we Christians have to reclaim. Not Jesus against the Jews, but Jesus against every form of imperial, violent, oppressive power.
But in terms of the current American empire and the extent to which the Republic founded by the Founding Fathers that's endured for over 200 years is, you know, in terms of the difference between temporal power, empire, and spiritual power is pretty stark. And frankly, I'm more concerned, or just as concerned, about our spiritual decline, if you will. If the fact of the matter is we are now having a debate about the issue that you just raised, the torture issue, and we're not debating the hideous nature and immorality of torture, but we're debating whether or not it worked or not.
That's all too much the tone of the discussion so far. There was a NBC Wall Street Journal poll released this week that showed a majority of Americans believe that the instances of enhanced interrogation, so-called, laid bare in the Senate report are justified. That is to say, a majority of Americans accept torture. It's an astonishment and a true signal of our spiritual malaise. Another one, if I could lift it up, is what's at the bottom of this bizarre and quite frightening hacking of the internal communications of the Sony Corporation, generated apparently by a film called The Interview, as I recall. I haven't seen it, but I This film, The Interview, recently released, is the premise of it, apparently. Again, I acknowledge that I haven't seen it. But it's a comedy based on a story of a couple of CIA operatives who are out to assassinate the leader of North Korea. When did assassination of a named, real, sitting head of state become fodder for laughs in the United States? Who have we become that we can imagine the assassination of a foreign head of state? I don't care how we define his state or his role as a ruler. When did that become part of what the United States of America thinks is funny? I'm of the generation that was traumatized by the assassinations of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. If you had told me I would live long enough in this country to find people treating assassination as a joke, I wouldn't have believed you. So who are we? It's a question that John McCain asked in the debate on the Senate floor after the release of the Senate torture report. He said, this isn't a question about our enemies. It's a question about us, about who we were, who we are, and who we aspire to be. Well, Christmas isn't a bad time to ask such questions. And the story that we have at Christmas is a story that's essentially critical of violent imperial power. And alas, the call to the United States of America is to ask the question, have we become a kind of version of Rome? And the answer, I'm afraid, is we have. And we have to think much more deeply about who we've become, and we've got to change it.
And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment and return to the conversation with James Carroll.
God is a concept by which we measure our pain. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we're continuing the conversation with James Carroll. So, given the parallels that you have made so eloquently clear, that we are more like the Romans and that we've also confused the real story of Jesus, particularly the historical Jesus, in the sense that we bought into this idea that comes from the fact that the Gospels were written in such a way that the Jews became the treacherous ones, the Romans almost became the benign ones, and thus are the some of the seeds of anti-Semitism. What's your sense then of the role of the Christian Church in trying to heal that divide? There's been, obviously, Pope Francis has made efforts to reach out to Jewish leaders, and clearly the interfaith question that most troubles me today is the casual way in which Islam is corrupted in the media as being almost synonymous with terrorism. I mean, let's look at what just happened a few weeks ago in Sydney, Australia, where a person who should have been committed into an asylum or into some medical care had terrible personal record of criminality et cetera, was clearly a disturbed individual. Yet the fact that he put up an Islamic flag, which he didn't even have, he asked the police, the SWAT team surrounding him, to provide him with this black flag, which he held up And that made this story, which would otherwise not have been only just a local story, an international story, simply because this person was trying to claim some association with the Islamic State. Now, the fact that the Islamic State calls itself the Islamic State, we should not give them the benefit of being able to repeat that name all the time, because they have nothing to do with Islam. They're a bunch of murderers and thugs and rapists. And the Arabs, in the Arab world, they refer to the Islamic State as Daesh, which is a kind of derogatory way to describe their acronym. And the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, you can't use that word Islam all the time, or Islamic, in the context of talking about this outrageous organization. And I just can't believe that, you know, that this story was turned into an international front page story because of a completely false association with Islam.
Well, you know, it's very important point you're making, and I couldn't agree more. In Christ Actually, I pushed the argument further and back into history, because I'm arguing that the structure of the imagination of the West, which first pit Christians against Jews, ultimately in the period of the Crusades, pit European believers against what were called Islamic infidels. Europe came into a positive identity about itself over against the negative identity of Islam in the period of the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries, that succession of misbegotten holy wars that we call the Crusades. And again, we have to remember that there was a signal of this when President Bush early on called this war on terror a crusade, a phrase that he used without any particular sense of its historical resonance, but which was heard in the Arab world with a direct reference to this trauma that lives on in the Arab memory of the religious wars against Islam that were launched from Europe in the name of God. God wills it, the Pope said. That basic structure of imagination, positive Europe over negative Islam, continues to be a bug in the software of the West today. And to unpack that bug, to debug it, in effect, I'm arguing that we Christians have a special obligation, which is to return to our Gospels, see where this positive-negative bipolarity came from, and disarm it. Learn to read our Gospels differently. Understand where they came from. Listen to them as if we ourselves are Jews, and submit everything we believe about Jesus to the test that he himself was always fully and completely a Jew, a man, a son of Israel, fully and completely to the day he died. My argument is, unless we Christians do this, the bug in the software will live on, and we have to debug it at all costs. It's deadly, deadly, deadly.
So how do you then, just going back to this idea of an interfaith dialogue, obviously a dialogue is insufficient. It's a place to start, but it's certainly not working in measurable way, given the sectarian divides and we're engaged in a third war in Iraq, and obviously it's going to be a boon for the contractors, and it'll go on for a long time because the Republicans don't want to admit that this whole mess in Iraq was created by George W. Bush and Cheney and company. And Obama doesn't want to be the president who lost Iraq, even though it's already lost. And that will probably continue on with Hillary Clinton or Jeb Bush, whoever takes over in our oligarchical political structure.
Well, the war party is riding high, that's for sure. It's very discouraging. But the truth of where these wars have led is very for the world to see. It's very clear, isn't it, that we have created catastrophe throughout the Middle East. And the American purposes have not been served, have not been and are not being served by our military intervention. And all I can say is it's so blatantly evident that I can only hope that more and more and more Americans will begin to face it. We have ignited a vast cultural war here. It was not ignited by Osama bin Laden, by Al-Qaeda. It was ignited by the way we chose to respond to them, and we're still doing it. So every time the subject comes up, we have to face this truth, I'd say.
Well, it's as though we took Osama bin Laden's bait, and we're the gift that keeps on giving. Everything that we do reinforces that idea that that the West is out to, you know, destroy Islam. I mean, that's true.
And the world of Islam is engaged in a ferocious and brutal civil war, and that's what it is. And whether it's Sunni versus Shia or modernists versus traditional people, or Arabs versus Persians, any way you cut it, this is a civil war, a classic, historic, long in the making civil war, and the United States of America has no business getting in the middle of it, and all we can do is make it worse. And the so-called Islamic State is a case in point, because the so-called Islamic State has the power it has today because it's armed with vast reserves of weapons that the United States introduced into the conflict in Iraq.
But I still wish, though, James, that we could call this organization, as the Arabs do, Daesh, you know.
Yes, well, I take your point.
That, by using Islamic, you're...
Yes, but for me, the important note is to say so-called Islamic State, so that people know what I'm talking about.
Right. But it's a habit that I find myself...
It's neither Islamic nor a state at this point.
Exactly, yeah. So anyway, what about the wars within this country, though? This extraordinary red-blue divide that became apparent in this last election, where the Democrats didn't show up to vote, and the results are going to be quite grim. Already we've seen this gift to Wall Street by a Republican congressman who literally took dictation from Citibank, who actually wrote the rider in the bill that's now law, and then, of course, it gives them the opportunity to revisit what they did that brought about the 2008 crash. So
it goes back to your earlier question about whether the republic will survive. I mean, what's at stake here is the future of democratic liberalism as the essential polity of the United States. We're in danger of losing it. This is how democracy undermines itself, and the danger is quite profound. I couldn't agree more. And it is appalling to think that we're restoring the economic structures that led to the fiscal collapse 7 years ago. Thank God for Elizabeth Warren blowing the whistle on it. But I agree with you. It's quite scary. And the upcoming political contest running for president, you know, in the tradition, every 4 years, we as a people are in a way required to engage in an act of self-criticism. It's hard for the presidential contest to avoid elements of self-criticism, and that's what's great about it. But if all of the candidates represent the same essential position underwritten by the same corporate sponsors, then our democracy is truly finished. That's very clear.
And in terms of the red state, blue state divide, the post-electoral map was so telling that the Democrats essentially are all in cities and they're all voting against each other because they're, you know, Republicans don't have much traction. And then you've got this vast rural part of America that's all red, which means that the Republicans are going to probably almost indefinitely control the House and perhaps the Senate too, and that the only hope that the Democrats have is to maintain the executive branch. And then you have, within this red state, blue state divide, you almost have the country moving in different directions. The blue states like California are reaching out to the 21st century, and the red states, and particularly in the South, are moving culturally back to the 17th century and economically back to the 19th century.
Yeah, well, I think it behooves us all, though, to avoid sweeping stereotypical condemnations of each other. I myself do live in a resoundingly blue state, Massachusetts.
Elizabeth Warren country.
Yeah, Elizabeth Warren country. But I have relatives throughout the country and relatives who don't agree with me on my politics. They're good people. They're good people. And we all have some of the most important things in common, care for our children and hope for the future and trying to protect the possibility of good jobs for our children who are growing and grown, education. What I'm looking for is a politics that can put us back in touch with what we have in common as a people. I refuse to think that we're just condemned to a kind of cultural war between red and blue, as destructive almost as the war between blue and gray was. There is something frightening at work, but I think we have to resolutely look out for, and of course the promise with which we elected Barack Obama was exactly this, and if there's a tragedy attached to Barack Obama, and I believe there is, it is that this man was politically, morally, and temperamentally committed to a kind of process of unification and healing, and not due to any failure of his, it proved to be impossible, which has destroyed much of his purpose and agenda, and leaving us in a way with a new level of division, which is an opening of the wound we thought was more healed than it is, of race. So these recent weeks in the United States with the laying bare of the radically unjust structure of American jurisprudence has been a profound setback. And it does leave one wondering if the election of a first African-American president hasn't in some way sparked this reaction. I hate to think so, but that's the way it seems. But what I love most about Barack Obama still is his understanding of the importance of holding up that ideal that we are not the red states and the blue states, that we are the United States. But alas, it doesn't seem like that ideal is close to being realized now.
And we're going to take a brief station break and return to the conversation with James Carroll after this brief break. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and we're continuing the conversation with James Carroll on this Christmas holiday. And James, you were just talking about the tragedy of Barack Obama, who really did try to heal the blue and red state divide, saying there's no red and blue states, there's only the United States. And it seemed to me that in many ways, you know, Fox News and other right-wing outlets have given Americans permission to hate this guy. They invented all kinds of terrible things about him to delegitimize him, that he was a Kenyan, he didn't have a passport, all of that crazy stuff. But it's sort of metastasized now into a kind of acceptable level of hatred, which I find extraordinary. And then on the political left, you have all of this disappointment and anger at this man because he wasn't sufficiently partisan. They feel that he should have been more partisan. So it is a tragedy. It really is.
It is a tragedy. Barack Obama never promised to be a man of the left. I'm comfortably associated as a man of the left myself, but I understood at the very beginning that he was a man committed to a kind of realpolitik. His foreign policy was not going to be a foreign policy of pacifism. It wasn't going to be a withdrawal from American power projected abroad. He promised to end the war in Iraq, but he also promised to expand the war in Afghanistan, which he did. I object to that. I also object to his general acceptance of the principles and assumptions of the Pentagon and the national security establishment. I regret it. But I do not feel in any way deceived by this man. And much of my disappointment goes to the obstacles that were thrown in his way, so that those things he aimed to accomplish, well, some of them he's accomplished quite powerfully, and including most recently perhaps a reconciliation with Cuba, which is hugely important, but unable to shut down Guantanamo, though he wants to, unable to really restructure the United States military structure, although he set that as a goal. And most tragically and frighteningly for me, his inability to move forward on what he declared in his early years as a top priority, which was the significant reduction of the American nuclear arsenal, which hasn't taken place. And I'm terribly afraid that President Obama's successors will never follow his lead and embrace the ideal of an ultimate nuclear abolition altogether. So there are a lot of things to be disappointed about, but that's a different thing than making President Obama himself the villain of the piece. It turned out the American political system itself was in a far graver state of dysfunction than we imagined. That problem transcends any individual, and it really belongs to all of us as a people. So we'll see how it goes heading forward. But my regard for the president and gratitude toward him stands, despite the ways in which I had hoped for different outcomes.
Again, we're speaking with James Carroll, a distinguished scholar in residence at Suffolk University and a columnist for the Boston Globe, the author of 11 novels and 7 works of nonfiction. James Carroll is a former priest who has been a civil rights worker, an anti-war activist, and a community organizer in Washington and New York. His New York Times bestseller, Constantine Sword, provided the basis for an award-winning documentary, and James Carroll's new book just out is Christ Actually, the Son of God for the Secular Age. And so, what's your sense then of, obviously, when you write a book, you try to, I guess, to put it bluntly, you try to save the world. Everybody would like, I'm sure, their books to become a part of a movement, and we can only hope that this book does. But in what direction do you want to move people?
Well, one of the reviewers of this book called me Christ-haunted, which is a phrase from Flannery O'Connor. I accept it and actually take it as a compliment to be associated with Flannery O'Connor. But the same reviewer said I was Christ-haunted, but also Holocaust-haunted. And that's true. I was born in 1943, which happens to be the year the word genocide was coined. And I have been haunted by the Holocaust. I'm a Catholic Christian. I'm not Jewish. I did not lose family members in the Holocaust. So I don't presume to claim to be haunted in that way. But I am haunted as a person who has had to reckon with the complicity of my own tradition in that grotesque crime. Not that the church or Christianity did it. Hitler did it. The Nazis did it. Their particular guilt must be insisted upon. But they couldn't have done it without the centuries-long tradition of Christian anti-Judaism that preceded them. I've written this book because I believe that the Holocaust lays bare a truth about Jesus Christ as well. And we have to revisit how we think of Jesus Christ in the light of the Holocaust. We'll never, ever think of Shylock, Shakespeare's character, again, the way we did before the Holocaust. And the same should be true of Jesus. And the bottom line of that reimagination that must take place is a full reckoning with the fact of Jesus as a Jew, and realizing what it means to understand that if Jesus were alive in the 20th century in Europe, he would not have been the savior of the world. He would have been one more unknown figure with a number on his arm. That's all. What does that mean to us Christians whose theology, whose long tradition of contempt for the Jewish people prepared for that turn in the story? What does that mean, the way in which we betrayed Jesus himself with our, not just with our crimes, but with our virtues, with the things we claimed were right about us, our being better than the synagogue, our being chosen of God in a way that the Jews were not? A very profound act of revision has to take place. It's begun. It began among Catholics with the Second Vatican Council, and it's continued through the heroic Jewish-Christian dialogue since World War II, heroic mostly on the part of Jewish leaders who, despite all that had been done, re-entered conversation with Christians to change the way these things are understood. So, for me, the Holocaust, reckoning with the Holocaust, means, in some basic way, reckoning with a new kind of theology about Jesus Christ. And once one changes the lens and begins to see him as a Shema reciting, kosher, Sabbath observing Jewish man with his head always covered, then the entire good news begins to look different. And it becomes even better, actually, because it suggests that God is present among us as one of us in the thick of all of our contradictions and confusions and sins. So Jesus, this is the season when the world takes note of Jesus again, but we should be seeing Jesus as never before, as fully and completely a man of the Jewish people. And then, and therefore, fully and completely, a man who eschewed power, chose service over status, and basically welcomed into his company everybody he met.
Well, just let me return to the quote that I read to you at the beginning, and it was a bit of a pop quiz there, and it turned out, of course, that the quote comes from Pope Francis. "It is not necessary to believe in God to be a good person. In a way, the traditional notion of God is outdated. One can be spiritual, but not religious. It is not necessary to go to church and give money. For many, nature can be a church. Some of the best people in history did not believe in God, while some of the worst deeds were done in his name." So let's take that, the spirit of that comment by Pope Francis, and imagine a way in which all of what the Pope is saying in terms of the spirituality that's out there amongst people, the wariness of structures, the abhorrence about what's been going on, particularly in the Catholic Church, etc., that the idea that nature can be a church. If you could gather together all of those people across all of the denominations around the world who feel that way, you would have a vast and powerful movement.
Well, the subtitle of my book is The Son of God for the Secular Age. Religious people often talk of the secular age with regret. I rejoice in it. The secular age is helping to purify religion. People who deny the existence of God are often denying trivial, shallow, anthropomorphic, and often triumphalistic notions of God that should be denied. So atheism can be a purification. We should welcome it, because it always reminds everybody, including believers, that none of us actually owns God. None of us, in truth, knows much about who God is. God, the point of God, the word God, is that it's beyond the capacity of human language to express it. And if we can all be a little bit more modest about what we know and what we claim, then that broad spirit of commonality that you just laid out for us becomes very real. We're all in the same boat here. And a division by religion is one of the most grotesque divisions in the human family, and especially when it becomes violent, which is finally my own strong conviction that the first obligation every religious person has, and every religion as such has, is to be self-critical. And by being self-critical, we do become open to the recognition of what's good, virtuous, and true in other people's lives and traditions, whether they're religious or not. The glory of being a Catholic right this minute, Ian, is that we do have, unexpectedly, this Pope who seems animated by just such a vision. And if the Catholic Church can have a Pope like Francis, then what isn't possible? That alone is a good, solid, realistic reason to be very hopeful about the future going forward.
Well, James Carroll, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
All the best to you, Ian. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with James Carroll, who's a distinguished scholar in residence at Suffolk University and a columnist for the Boston Globe, the author of 11 novels and 7 works of nonfiction. James Carroll is a former priest who has been a civil rights worker, an anti-war activist, and a community organizer in Washington and New York. He served as Catholic chaplain of Boston University and then left the priesthood to become a writer. He was named Best Columnist by the Catholic Press Association and received the first Thomas Merton Award. His books include House of War, The Pentagon, and The Disastrous Rise of American Power, An American Requiem, God, My Father, and The War That Came Between Us, and Jerusalem, Jerusalem, The Ancient City That Ignited the Modern World. And his New York Times bestseller, Constantine Sword, provided the basis for an award-winning documentary. James Carroll's new book, just out, is Christ Actually, the Son of God for the Secular Age. And this has been Background Briefing for Christmas Day. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. And this program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.